Some hemp growers in Illinois are finding that their plant is being mistaken for something else, marijuana, making their hemp crop a target for thieves. Plus, Illinois could soon join California, New York, and New Jersey in banning discrimination based on hair. And global sales of board games are expected to reach over $21 billion in the next 5 years. We'll talk to some of the Illinois folks behind the gaming boom.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Mary Hansen. Hemp and marijuana look and smell a lot alike. To the untrained eye or nose, it's hard to tell the difference between the two. That's presenting a problem for hemp growers in Illinois who are losing crops to thieves who steal it, thinking it's marijuana. To get into the issue, we're joined now by WILL's own agriculture reporter, Dana Cronin. Hi, Dana.
Hi.
We're also joined by DeMarcus Medley, a hemp farmer based in Galesburg. Welcome, DeMarcus.
Thank you.
So first off, Dana, let's go back to basics. Can you remind us the difference between hemp and marijuana?
Sure. Yeah. So marijuana and hemp are relatives of each other. They're derived from the same plant, the cannabis sativa plant. But the difference is in their levels of THC or tetrahydrocannabinol. And THC is that psychoactive component in marijuana that gets you high. And legal hemp only contains it should only contain 0.3% THC. Marijuana obviously contains more than that. And then as a reminder to folks, growing hemp in Illinois was legalized under former Governor Bruce Rauner with the Industrial Hemp Act. And then it was legalized nationwide under the 2018 Farm Bill. So this is the first year a lot of farmers in Illinois are growing hemp. And then separately, recreational marijuana consumption was legalized in Illinois on January 1st.
So a lot of changes with hemp and marijuana in the last couple of years here. And DeMarcus, I want to ask you, can you just tell me a little bit about your farm?
Yeah, my brothers and I, we own a small urban farm in Galesburg. It's about 4 acres. We primarily grow using a method called aquaponics, where we raise fish and food in a closed loop system. And this last year, we introduced hemp to our farm, where we grew some in our aquaponic system and also in the soil.
And so what happened to your hemp crop last year?
Well, last year we noticed that we only grew a small amount, maybe like 60 plants. And we started to notice that, you know, some of the hemp branches were missing from the plants. And we thought maybe a deer was going after it. And they were doing it, you know, every day for a few days. And we decided to set up a camera. And we found out it was actually people.
So, Dana, how much can hemp theft affect a farmer's livelihood? How valuable is the crop?
It's a really valuable crop. It's worth a lot of money. And I don't know exactly how much, you know, money-wise was lost this year, but I can tell you in DeMarcus's case, I read that police report, and he lost about $25,000 worth of the crop. So, you know, it's a really big deal to a lot of farmers.
And DeMarcus, so this was your first year. It sounded like you hit a few bumps in the road there. Do you think you'll do it again?
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to start my crop here soon in the greenhouse. So, yeah, I'm going to definitely grow it again.
And Dana, you wrote a story about DeMarcus's case and the issue more broadly. How did you hear about it initially?
Well, I was working on a story about hemp, and I had met with and talked on the phone to many different hemp farmers, and none of them were very interested in talking with me, especially on the record, because they felt like they were putting themselves on the map. You know, some had already had crops stolen, some had heard that their neighbors had had crops stolen, and that basically by talking to me, they felt like people would find out that they were growing hemp, and they thought that that was a risky move. And I was ultimately just shocked by the number of growers I talked to that were reluctant. So,
So it sounds like that's the anecdotal part of it, talking to these farmers, finding out that a lot of them are experiencing this. But in terms of numbers, how big of a problem is this? Do we actually know?
The short answer here is that no, we don't know. The Illinois Department of Agriculture did not keep track of it this year. I mean, it was the first year of hemp growing, so there are a lot of growing pains, a lot of things that they're still figuring out. But I can tell you that almost every hemp farmer I've spoken to either had their own hemp crop stolen or knew someone that did.
So it could be a pretty widespread problem. And you mentioned that right. The Illinois Department of Agriculture is aware of this. What has their response been?
Yeah, so I talked to Jeff Cox about this. He's the Bureau Chief of Medicinal Plants at the Illinois Department of Agriculture. And he told me that they have received calls from hemp farmers about this, but that it's mostly just growing pains. Here's what he said.
There's not a whole lot we can do about it. If thieves are going to steal, that's what they do. We just have to do our best to inform the public that what they're stealing is not what they think they're stealing.
He also told me that they're working on improving signage on hemp farms. That's one of their solutions. And I think that would look something like signs that say things like, this is industrial hemp growing. This is not marijuana.
Just to tell people without that discerning eye or nose what that crop is.
Right.
What else can be done to help farmers protect their crops?
So it sounds like for the most part, it'll be up to the farmers to protect their own crop. And DeMarcus can probably tell you more about that. But I did want to mention that I also spoke to Russ Idle. He's the chief of police in Galesburg, where, DeMarcus, you grow hemp. And he said this is the only case of hemp theft his station has seen. But he told me that they're working on increasing patrols around hemp farms because of the risk factor associated with the crop. I want to play a quick clip from him, too. Here he is.
We're aware of where the different hemp farms are, and we'll be wanting to kind of keep an eye on them and be on the lookout for people that don't look like they belong.
Is that something that you do for other farms?
Not really, but again, I think that this particular crop has a potential for theft or damage that maybe others don't.
So it sounds like it'll mostly be up to local police stations to deal with this. And that's also what Jeff Cox at the Illinois Department of Agriculture told me, that this is going to be a law enforcement issue.
And DeMarcus, you reported the stolen hemp from your farm to the Galesburg Police Department. What are you going to do in the future to protect your crop?
We're going to have several. We're just going to try to slow the thieves down if they do intend on coming back. Because honestly, I don't think the thieves care if it's hemp or marijuana. It looks like marijuana, so they can, you know, potentially just sell it and, you know, get away with it before the person, you know, smokes it and find out it's not what they said it is. So I don't think that matters. And for us, we're just going to install cameras, guard dogs, and just do our due diligence to try to prevent as much theft as possible.
That was WILL and Harvest Public Media reporter Dana Cronin and DeMarcus Medley. He's a hemp farmer based in Galesburg. Thank you both so much for being on the show.
Thanks.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Mary Hansen. Illinois could soon join California, New York, and New Jersey in banning discrimination based on hair. State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth, a Democrat from Peoria, is sponsoring legislation that would amend the Illinois Human Rights Act. It would expound on the word race and traits associated with race, so that a person with a certain hair texture or hairstyle, such as locks, braids, and twists, could not be discriminated against. Representative Gordon Booth says this bill would help Black and Latino citizens who are disproportionately impacted by hairstyle discrimination in the workplace. WILL News Director Reginald Hardwick sat down with four women who shared their experiences related to hair harassment and, in some cases, hair discrimination.
We're going to talk with four women who can speak directly with experiences related to hair harassment and, in some cases, hair discrimination. Joining me in studio is Robin Hendry, Vice President of Vince Colors Group, a Black-owned ad agency. Brittany Wright, a Chicago-based digital media specialist. And University of Illinois journalism professor, Dr. Janice Collins. Welcome to The 21st.
Thank you for having us.
This is great.
We'll also have one more guest on the phone coming up. But first, I'm going to do something a little bit different because this is radio and people can't see you. So I'm going to ask all of our studio guests to describe their hairstyle. Robin, I'll start with you.
Oh, my hair is gray. That's the first thing that people notice. But I wear my hair in a wash and go, which means that it's not really that easy, but it's a texturized look. It's curly for some, kinky for others, and it's about shoulder length, and I get a lot of attention, mostly because of the gray.
Brittany?
I was going to say a kinky, curly, wonderfully made afro. I want to say wash and go, but it takes prayer. Yeah.
And Janice?
And I have locks. And that I twist myself, and they're fairly long past my backside, actually. So I've been growing them for since 2003, I believe, in remembrance of my rebirth from my mother's passing, and in honor of her and my strength again.
Robin, why do you think a bill banning discrimination based on hair texture or hairstyle is necessary?
Discrimination in any form or fashion is wrong. However, this type of discrimination has a profound effect on Black females. It's wrong, and we have to say something. It's happened for years, it's happened for decades, and at this point, we have to work together to make sure that the Crown Act, which is creating an open world for natural hair, is passed. It is ridiculous that we have to get legislation to avoid this type of discrimination. And we are working together in different communities, and I'm hoping that we'll have more than just three states to pass this legislation. I know that there are efforts at the federal level. It needs to happen so it protects all of these women and men and young boys and girls who are growing up in a world where they feel that they have freedom. But at this point, we don't.
Brittany, you did not always wear your hair natural, like we talked earlier. No. In fact, you felt some pressure to wear it differently when you entered the corporate world. What are some of the things people have said to you when you've had two different hairstyles?
When I started out, I was perming my hair. I grew up having a perm in my hair. It was always, that's what was acceptable for me. That's what I was told was acceptable. When I would straighten my hair, I would typically straighten it annually to cut my hair, to trim it, which is common for the natural hair community. And I found that, you know, when I would straighten it again, people would say, oh, you look professional today. Or it looks tame. It looks neat today. And it's one of those things that's meant to be a compliment, but in another layer of saying that you're exotic, you're different, that this doesn't belong here. So that definitely has an effect on someone.
Recent news accounts have documented rejection of natural hair texture in very public ways. Take the case of DeAndre Arnold, a student in Texas who was told in January to cut his locks or not be allowed to participate in his high school graduation. Or Andrew Johnson, a high school wrestler in New Jersey who was told in December of 2018 to cut off his locks or forfeit a match. Here's an excerpt from ABC News.
Discussed tonight over this video now circulating the internet of this moment of humiliation. New Jersey high school wrestler Andrew Johnson having his dreadlocks cut by a trainer before a match. He was forced to have his hair cut by a referee in order to compete or forfeit the match. It's standard for wrestlers with long hair to have the option to cover their heads, but the referee, Alan Maloney, would not allow it.
Janice Collins, you have locks. You are a journalism professor here at U of I. You wear them to class and everywhere you go. First, what is your reaction to hearing that account of teenagers facing retribution for their hair?
It was painful. It was painful to watch. It reminded me of the moment that I saw a young child at 6 being handcuffed. It is traumatic. I had a lot of questions, even from the standpoint of media, that why would they have to do it in front of everyone, first of all? Why would you have to cut his locks in front of everyone? It's a form of shaming. And I think what is shameful is when the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals made it legal to discriminate because of dreadlocks or because of locks that are connected to the majority of people of color. Let me say that. Because it, please help me and correct me if I'm wrong. Is there any other aggregate that has to face legal sanctions for their hair in the United States? Is there another hairstyle that has received legal sanctions for a particular type of hairstyle other than locks? I've been looking, I've been searching. If not, it should be illegal. Point. I agree with Robin, and I agree with what Brittany has said. This is America, and we have to allow people and an environment, develop and create an environment where we can pursue life, liberty, and happiness without hurting someone. Either way, you're going to be discriminated against, whether you're a woman, whether you're a person of color, whether you're short, whether you're tall. But for the legal system to sanction and give a stamp of approval that it is okay to discriminate against someone as far as even their way of living, employment, based on a hairstyle, I think is deplorable. And I think that's why we need the Crown Act to address that and challenge that and transcend and transform that. It is going in the wrong direction. And I think for the most part, a lot of Americans will agree.
We're talking with Robin Henry, Vice President of Vince Colors Group, a Black-owned ad agency, Brittany Wright, a Chicago-based digital media specialist, and University of Illinois journalism professor Dr. Janice Collins. We're talking about an anti-hair discrimination bill that's being introduced in the Illinois State House this session. We have a lot more coming up. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick, and we are talking about an anti-hair discrimination bill that's been introduced in the Illinois State House this session. And we were talking with Robin Henry, Vice President of Vince Colors Group, a Black-owned ad agency, Brittany Wright, a Chicago-based digital media specialist, and University of Illinois journalism professor Janice Collins. Robin Henry, you are an ad exec, and what do you say to a person who argues, well, what's wrong with schools or businesses deciding the look they think is appropriate, and that should include hair?
People are more important than dress codes, people's feelings. People are parents. People are responsible citizens. People have talent that businesses need and pay plenty of money for such talent that has no bearing on what hairstyle they bring to work on their heads. That's a personal choice. There are many personal choices we make that allow us to get to work every day that have no, there's no right for anyone to make a decision for another person who's a professional, who has proven that they can do the job. So there's no reason that their hairstyle should come up for any type of consideration other than the person who's wearing the hairstyle. That's it.
This discussion about hair harassment is not new. Renelda Muse is the first woman and first African-American to anchor a TV newscast in Denver. In 1968, a few months after being on the air, she changed her hairstyle from shoulder-length straight hair to an afro and experienced quite a reaction from the audience. She recently testified at a House committee in Colorado to pass an anti-hair discrimination bill there. And Renelda joins us on the line from Denver. Hello, Renelda.
Hi, Reginald. How are you?
I'm great, and I do have a little bit of a personal note here. I grew up in Colorado. Renelda is a lifelong mentor of mine, but I felt her historic perspective on this topic was very pertinent to this conversation. I want to ask you first, why did you change your hair at that moment in 1968?
I think I wanted to be seen. Seen as the person I was, which was a young African-American woman. And adopting an Afrocentric hairstyle was the clearest way to make that statement. And certainly the decision grew out of the context of the times. I literally grew up and came of age during the Civil Rights Movement. I graduated college, Ohio State University, in 1968. That's the same year that black students there made demands and took over the administration building. It was the same year that MLK was murdered. It was the same year that Tommy Smith and John Carlos staged their heroic protest at the Mexico City Olympics. The same year that James Brown released his hit song, I'm Black and I'm Proud. So to cut my hair into an afro then, at that time, was just a logical extension of that consciousness or awareness.
What was the reaction from station management and the audience?
Well, from the audience, I'd have to say bewilderment, shock, confusion, some anger. Because I was the first to do this in Denver, a city with a relatively small ethnic minority population, it was quite a shock. It was radical. And especially since Angela Davis was a major figure in the news at that time, and my hairstyle mirrored hers almost exactly. So I think the question was, did some in the audience conflate my hairstyle with her political views? I don't know. People weren't sure what to think. Many viewers urged me to wear my hair like Barbara Walters, who was the most prominent white woman reporter at the time. Still others suggested that I adopt a more traditional and non-threatening hairstyle like Coretta Scott King. And still others raged. They wrote letters, you know, that began, "Dear Jungle Bunny." Now, management, on the other hand, they were equally as confused and uncertain about how to handle the situation. If they sanctioned or fired me, they ran the risk of angering the minority community, and they also put in jeopardy the corporate investment they had made in diversity. So what they did was sort of come at it sideways in a sometimes comical, inept way. They told me things like the cameras couldn't frame my afro. The news director called me into his office and offered his wife's services to style my hair, as if it were an issue of my not knowing what to do with my hair, and as if a white woman could offer direction to a black woman on her own hair. It was ludicrous, it was laughable, it was insulting.
Well, Renelda, thank you for taking time to join us on the line from Denver.
My pleasure.
According to Essence magazine, in 2018, the black hair care industry raked in an estimated $2.5 billion, that's with a B, dollars. Much of that money is spent by black women on chemical relaxers to change the texture from curly to straight, or buying weaves or wigs, which can give the appearance of straight hair. Robin, your ad agency has represented black hair products for years. This can be an expensive process.
Yes, taking care of hair, period, can be expensive. There are many products that are deemed inexpensive, but at this point, I feel you get what you pay for. The results, for me, have been very consistent with what I just said. I've tried the less expensive products, and they really do not work. One of the biggest problems is the chemical makeup is cheap to make, so they can make a profit at a smaller price. So if you think about it, in most cases, and I'm not guaranteeing if you pay more, you're going to get a better response from your hair. But for me, when I invest in my hair, just like if I invest in better food at the grocery store, I get a better response. And it's healthier. It's more consistent. It's something I can predict. The business aspect of black hair is something that has changed. Relaxers were a huge segment of the market years ago. But because so many of us have decided to transition from relaxers or no longer purchase relaxers or do big chops and just eliminate relaxers right away, the impact has changed. So the curly hair, the natural hair, the locks, braids, and any type of hair care products that are purchased for natural hair are taking over. So we have made our message quite clear.
And then there's the psychological toll. And Brittany Wright, let me ask you,
the psychological toll of changing your hair to conform to society and maybe straightening it. Did that ever enter your mind, and how young were you when that happened?
So it never occurred to me. And as you said, it really is a journey back to yourself. For me, it was stepping away from what my family knew, stepping away from how my mother taught me to do my hair. I remember the moment that I went to a store and I was trying to put another perm in my hair, and I was looking for a particular brand. They didn't have it. And I remember coming across a box that there's different scales to approach the thickness of your hair. So there's a kitty perm, there's the regular, and then there's like the thick or coily or kinky or coarse. And so this particular brand had something called resistant. And I was like, what does that mean? Is it resistant to a comb? What does that mean? And so that just really, it felt like I had gotten stabbed in the chest. And from that moment on, I just could not bring myself to put another perm in my hair. And I had to figure it out on my own. I mean, I didn't have anybody in my family, any of my friends, nobody at that time was naturally haired, like curly haired, or, you know, everyone straightened their hair. You know, we have like all these war stories about going to the shop, getting our hair pressed, or getting our hair pressed, you know, by our grandmothers and things like that. And so for me, it was really like returning to or trying to discover who I was, you know, like without like this straight hair, without this idea of what my mom and my grandmother and her mother before her taught them, you know, the standard of beauty. And so for me, that's really when it also helped me in other areas of my life. You know, in figuring out who I was authentically with the hair on my head, you know, I was able to discover like, oh, you can shine through in this other way, you know. So it really is something that I think everyone has to go through. And it's so personal, you know. Perhaps you don't wear it curly, or maybe you don't have like the kinky coily hair, but maybe you have a looser pattern, and that's okay. You know, you wear your hair in a bun, that's still natural. You know, it's just not conforming to what someone else's idea of what your hair is supposed to be. And so in that moment in that store where I saw resistant, was kind of a life-changing experience for me.
Robin, you speak to groups of young African-American adults about hair. What do you tell them, especially those going into the corporate world?
It's important to be who you are, to be authentic. If you go to an interview with your hair in its natural state and you're rejected, not based on your abilities, not based on your experience or your resources or the gifts that you can bring to that company, but because of your hair, run and feel blessed that they were honest enough to reject you. Mm-hmm. It's terrible to think that you have to be anything other than who you are, who you were born with, what gifts you were given. I have gray hair, and I'm very proud of it. I call it God's highlights. And many people aren't comfortable with that, but that's their problem. If someone didn't want to offer me a job because of my gray, kinky, curly hair, I don't want to work there. That's it. And I tell my students, I'm your role model. I've made every mistake. I've ventured out there. Trust me, I know what's going to happen. And you're better off working for somebody who respects you as you are.
For some people who may not be familiar with black hair texture or hairstyles, they may be tempted to reach out and touch a stranger's hair. I've heard black women talk about this a lot. Why do so many people, black women, others, black men, even who have larger hair, consider that a form of harassment? And Brittany, I'll start with you.
Because I started fanning myself. It's an invasion of personal space. And to treat someone as a pet or something that's on exhibition because you're not used to it, that doesn't mean you need to invade my space. You can ask me questions about my hair. I'm very comfortable answering questions. You know, some people don't know. They don't understand that our hair holds water differently than, you know, a looser curl pattern. But yeah, it's so inappropriate. It's so inappropriate to touch someone without, especially without their permission. I admire people who want to start that conversation and will allow that into the conversation. I'm not one of those people, but I've definitely had encounters where someone has reached out. I've actually had more encounters where someone wanted to touch my hair when I straightened it. So people that I worked with would see my hair and it's when it's straightened or pressed and then want to touch my hair because they are shocked that, you know, my hair could, you know, look like that or it can be that long or that it's authentically my hair, you know, with heat on it. So it's regardless, whatever state it's in, it's not a permission to invade anyone's space.
Janice, I mean, you are in the classroom with maybe some students who've not lived among African Americans. That, you know, this may be their first extension in contact or maybe seeing locks. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had that kind of experience with some of your students or?
Not really with my students. For a while, I've been teaching for 18 years, and I've had to tell some students that just because I have locks doesn't mean I partake in certain recreational activities because I have locks. And it doesn't mean that I listen only to reggae music. But it wasn't malicious. We have a great time with it. And I have also had individuals. I was just in Shenzhen, China. And I usually have my hair wrapped because for my locks at this time, they're like my skin. They're like the energy. And so you don't want individuals to put their energy into your hair. That's number one. And it is about personal space. However, I do believe, I feel like Brittany, that it's a time that you can educate. And I don't get offended immediately. I said, okay, just let me tell you, don't want to touch the hair. And some people go a little bit overboard. I think we can handle that. But I do believe that education is really important to combat ignorance about certain things and certain people. In certain cultures, in certain traditions. But I have to say that I really don't have nightmare stories to tell, I think, because I think the way you present yourself also helps if you're very outspoken about who you are. I think that helps a lot. And I just want to say before we go that to all the sisters that are wearing wigs and weaves and all that, just like I want to have the freedom to do what I want to do with my hair, I totally support you, men and women, about what you want to do with your hair as well. As long as you don't hurt yourself, try not to do that. So I've been very blessed.
Well, thank you, all of you, for joining us. And that's all the time we have. I want to thank Robin Henry, Vice President of Vince Colors Group, Black-owned ad agency. Brittany Wright, a Chicago-based digital media specialist and University of Illinois journalism professor. Dr. Janice Collins, thank you for joining us in the studio.
Thank you, Reginald.
This was great, so Reginald.
Yeah. And thanks to Renelda Muse, my mentor and a retired TV anchor in Denver, for joining us on the phone. And all of them joined us to talk about an anti-hair discrimination bill that's been introduced in the Illinois State House this session. I'm Reginald Hardwick, and we leave you now with a song from India Irie that addresses this issue.
Is that India? What happened to her hair? Little girl with the pressing curl. Age 8, I got a Jerry curl. 13, and I got a relaxer. I was the source of so much laughter. At 15, when it all broke off. 18, and I went all natural. February 2002, I went on and did what I had to do. Because it was time to change my life. To become the woman that I am inside. 97 dreadlocks all gone. I looked in the mirror for the first time and saw that, hey, I am not my hair. I am not this skin. I am not your expectations. No, no. I am not my hair. I am not this skin. I am the soul that lives within.
What's she doing to her hair?
I don't know. It looked crazy. I like it.
Yeah. I wouldn't go that far.
Good hair means curls and waves. Bad hair means you look like a slave. At the turn of the century, it's time for us to redefine who we be. You can shave it off like a
a South African beauty. Got it on lock like Bob Marley. You can rock it straight like Oprah Winfrey. If it's not what's on your head, it's what's underneath. And say hey.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Mary Hansen. Think about your favorite board games growing up. Maybe it was Monopoly, Candyland, Risk, or one of my favorites, The Game of Life. You might think board games are just for kids, or have declined in popularity since video games came on the scene. But board games are booming. The global sale of board games and puzzles are expected to reach over $21 billion by 2025. Today, we'll be delving into the world of board games. This past weekend, our intern, Eunice Alpason, went to a Saturday beer and board games event at the coffee shop Cafeteria and Company in Urbana. The event was co-hosted by Kudo Plays, an organization that hosts an Illinois local board game design competition.
My name is Matt Cho. I'm the owner of Cafeteria and Company in downtown Urbana. What we try to do is just do something that's a little bit more, I guess, relaxed than going out and hitting the bars. And this was kind of an interesting way to use a coffee shop that was already kind of closing down at the end of the night.
I'm Rebecca Nauer. I am the treasurer for both Kudo and Kudo Plays. There's a lot of social games here. It's kind of like a low-risk way to start knowing someone, is you both are focused on the same task, but you also get to know, like, how competitive they are, how fun they are when they insult people, or if they're a sore loser, and it's a good way to, like, build rapport with people that's not so pressured as, I'm going to stare into your eyes and have a coffee.
My name is Maya Gouliard. 3 years ago, I was working as a waitress on a really busy night, and I thought how similar it was to a board game. And I said, this should be a board game. And then a year ago, I was a bartending for a Kudo event, and I was just chatting with them, and I was like, I had an idea once. And they were like, well, you should do it. And then this year, I said, is it too late for me to do this? And they said, no. So I just went with it. And so I created this board game, and I just turned it in last week.
Now joining us in the studio, we have Katie Biquette, co-chair and director of operations of Kudo Plays. Also on the line with us, we have Kyle Tommy, owner and operator of Hungry Hippo Board Game Cafe in Decatur. Both of you, welcome to The 21st.
Hi there, Mary. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Kyle, I want to start with you. Tell me how you were first introduced to board games as a kid.
Sure. So actually for me, it was during family gatherings when I was a child, around Thanksgiving, Christmas, and oddly enough, 4th of July gatherings for family reunions. We would all gather around the table and play games. And I was honestly probably too young to play a lot of the games that I played with, but my family just let me join in and play with them. And I learned right along with them and just absolutely loved it. And every time that was my favorite thing, I looked forward to it. And then after that, it just sprung into kind of an addiction. And next thing you know, I have 500. So
that's quite a lot. And Katie, the world of board games has expanded since the 80s and 90s. For listeners who may not be in the loop, could you talk a little bit about the different types of board games that that are offered now?
Sure thing. A lot of people are probably familiar with the like path games and classic card games like of their childhood that they would play with their families. There was sort of a board game renaissance about 10 years ago when the game Settlers of Catan came over from Germany, and it sparked a lot of interest again in board games because they used to be very much war games or card games, like I mentioned. This new type of game, like called a Euro game, was something that has a lot of strategy and also interesting themes. And then there came to be more representation in actual like game designers and broader themes in games and more different ways to play them. So it really sparked a kind of a revolution. It's led to a really, really wide array of board games that are available for people to play and available for different types of people too as well.
Yeah, there might be a similar sort of trend that's happened in video games as well, sort of mirroring that. And we reached out to listeners from Facebook about their favorite board games. We heard from a lot of people, including Dan from Metamora, Illinois. He says he's often asked about his favorite board game because he goes to a 4-day gaming convention and has over 300 games, so close to your 500, Kyle. But for the past few years, he says the game at the top of his list has been Tuluva. Have either of you played that game?
I actually haven't. Sorry.
No, neither have I actually.
Oh, so that'll be a new one to add to the collection. Mm-hmm. And Kyle, you opened a board game cafe in Decatur. What made you want to open a store or cafe like that?
Honestly, it kind of started with my collection at the time, which was only a little over 200, and I had people coming over to my house quite frequently, and a lot of the games were not being played just because we didn't have the time. So they would sit on the shelf and be replaced by newer, funner, cooler games, or just the fact that we had played them once and we wanted to learn a new game. So I was thinking of different ways, maybe a library system, a rental system. And a friend of mine actually reached out to me about them starting a board game cafe in Granite City, Illinois, called the Board Gamery, Novel Ideas. And so I was kind of sparked off of them, and they kind of gave me a lot of ideas that they were working on. And I thought, hey, if they're asking me the questions for their board game cafe to know what kind of games and things like that, it looks like I already have a foot up on them, and I could probably start one of my own. And then I went and visited somewhere in Chicago and St. Louis area, and next thing you know, I own my own. So,
yeah. So, what's the experience like of walking into your board game cafe? What will people find there?
Sure. So, as soon as you walk in, you're going to see to your left immediately all the games, which is now over 540. And then you can just to the right is where you would check in. You just come in, and $5 a person. You play as many games as you want for as long as you want. I also offer espresso, coffee, chips, snacks, things like that. And then it's just a bunch of basically kind of mom and pop chairs, like something you would sit around your home kitchen and play. So I have a bunch of different styles and mismatched chairs and tables, and people can just sit around, and you often hear people laughing or yelling at each other, or, you know, just all sorts of things that you do around the table while playing games.
Similar to those family reunions you talked about, right?
Yes, exactly.
And Katie, you work with Kudo Plays. Tell me what the mission of that organization is.
Kudo Plays is a 6-month-long program where we actually take local people here in the CU area in Champaign-Urbana, and we walk them through how to design their own board game. It kicks off with a few meetings to, like, show folks what our events are going to be and what the range of the competition is. And then we have people create teams who are interested in working together to create board games. And from there, we offer specified, like, workshops to help them through specific things, like fabrication, which is a workshop that we offer at our local community fab lab, or writing rules. And then we also host a bunch of playtest events. So we help people create their own board game out of just, like, paper and cardboard. And then we do as much community engagement as possible so that they can get feedback on that game and make it even better. The teams turn in their games just last week, actually, in February, and we'll have our big event called a Grand Exhibition March 29th here in Champaign-Urbana at Broadway Food Hall. It's when we get all the games back to their teams, and then the public can come and play them and just see what's come from our local designers. So we're in our 7th season now, so we've existed for 7 years and produced probably, like, well over 100 games that people either take on to be published or just play with their friends.
And so what do you think is so fun about making these board games?
I like board games because it brings people together. And in particular, making board games is just an interesting design experience, because you have to get immediate feedback. People have to understand how it works, and they have to have fun. And it's just a really neat experiment in being able to take a unique idea, see if you can abstract it to the point of gamification, and then make art and theme that goes along with it to guide people through that experience. So guiding people through, like, a shared experience where they can have fun together, maybe get a little bit frustrated together, is always really fun to see. And we really hope to have, like, diverse participants in our organization, and so it's really fun to see the types of games that are developed that might not even be, like, out on the market.
And so another one of our listeners, Lindy, she says some games that are out on the market, Pandemic and Catan, I'm assuming that's Settlers of Catan that you mentioned, were some of her favorites. Kyle, why do you think board games are still so popular in the digital age, when people have lots of other options on their phone or video games?
For me, I think personally that the internet kind of takes away some of that face-to-face communication, obviously. And I think that we're starting to see a lot of board games come back into popularity, because I secretly think we kind of missed that. People really just want to be with their friends and family, and a lot of times people feel lonely when they're on social media. And I think that just having the game to bring people back together, you can see the excitement on their face. You can see them laughing. You can see them smiling. You can see them getting upset. And then next thing you know, they want to play another one and try something new. And I think it just rejuvenates kind of their spirits. And I think that even though we have all this technology, secretly we're kind of yearning for something a little bit more personal. And I think that's what games bring to the table.
Yeah. And Katie, I wanted to ask the same to you. What do you think makes board games so special now?
Oh, I largely agree, actually. We do miss kind of like being together and having a shared experience face to face. There are some video games that do that, but there's also something I think about a unique experience as far as like a tactile experience, too. And right now there's a current trend, and I think board games of having really unique and weird looking table presence. And that's also something you don't really get from a video game. And so I believe that I totally agree. Yeah, that shared experience is what people are looking for, being able to come together, have a common experience they can talk about, joke about, and then just being able to spend time together, I think is important.
And so for some people, including one of our producers here on the show, board games to them mean boring. What would you tell a friend, Kyle, that says that to you? Any recommendations for them?
Yeah, I think that person's probably thinking of the game that they grew up hating, like Monopoly that took forever with grandma or something like that. And I think it's just a matter of finding the right game for the right person. I could tell you there's some games that I love to play and with one group of people, but absolutely hate the same exact game with a different person. So it all depends on who you're playing with and what style of game you guys like. And I can bet you there's a game that they actually will enjoy.
And so for those folks who maybe aren't into board games, what would be a good sort of introduction game for them?
I think that there's a game called Carcassonne, which is fairly simple. And it's basically a tile laying down game where you kind of build your own map. It's very simple and it's a good introductory game. As well as even Bananagrams. It's basically a speed Scrabble where you don't actually have to keep score and you don't have to be really good at spelling. You can just throw together some simple words and still win. So I think something like that that's fast-paced, quick, and you don't have to worry about score so much, just about completing your crossword, can kind of help people get back into a game that they maybe dreaded to begin with.
Yes, I can attest to the Bananagrams. I've seen some pretty outrageous and silly Bananagrams. What about you, Katie? What would you recommend to somebody who might not be into board games?
I usually try and my collection is specifically kind of like made to be like beautiful and have kind of what I call like gateway games, or what I privately call bear trap games, which is just ways for people to kind of be tricked into making more strategic decisions than they realize they're doing because the game is so beautiful and easy to pick up. So I'd probably suggest something like one of our favorite kind of social deduction games called Skull or Skull and Roses, which is basically poker with nothing but bluffing. And it's beautiful, and people don't realize how complex it is until they start playing it. Kind of getting people into those like more fun party-ish games are a way that I use to gauge whether or not someone's into higher strategy. So I'd also suggest something like a Spyfall, where everyone gets a location on a card except for one person who is the spy, and you have to figure out, if you're the spy, where the other people are, and the people who know where they are have to figure out who the spy is by asking one another extremely vague but still very pointed questions. So I try to, if someone has come to me and said that they don't enjoy board games, I try to find more maybe like party style engaging games for them, and then I see what they pick up on. If they really like the art, if they really like the story, then I might go a different direction. If they really like the take that and kind of meanness of it, they might not be a person who's fun to play with me, but
maybe more on the competitive side.
Yes, but I have plenty of suggestions for them and plenty of friends who wouldn't mind playing with them as well.
And so a lot of these games I've never heard of. Where do you find them? Where do you purchase them? Is this sort of like an Amazon thing or Target? Where are you finding these games?
I am always one to try to embrace your community. So my first suggestion is just open up your preferred browser and just search for a board game store near you. We're very lucky here in Champaign-Urbana to have like 3 or 4 technically, and I highly suggest people go and take a look. It's a little bit easier to navigate even than Amazon, even though it might be overwhelming
to go to a physical space, they still have people who work there who can usher you to the types of games that you like or make suggestions for you. Board games do exist on Amazon and Target, that's true. But I think the point is to engage with other people and see what they like to play with one another. And at your local, friendly local board game store, you'll even be able to see those games in action. Oh, and if you're lucky enough to have a board game cafe, of course. We don't. We'll see if that changes the next few years. Fingers crossed.
That was thank you both so much for being here. That was Katie Bacay, co-chair and director of operations at Kudo Plays. Also, we spoke with Kyle Tommy, owner and operator of Hungry Hippo Board Game Cafe in Decatur. Thank you guys both so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Mary Hansen. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.